Welcome to Fresno Landia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Rob Parsons, filling in for Daniel Bergstrom.
We've got a great episode for you today. We're going to start by going through some of the headlines before we bring in reporter Greg Weaver to discuss an ongoing issue related to water contamination in Fresno. And then finally, we'll wrap up with what we're loving this week. So, Rob, what's in the news this week?
It was quite a week in Fresno. The city council was pretty busy. I think I'll start with, after 5 years of debate and back and forth between developers, environmental interests in the city, the council killed the South Central Specific Plan, a pretty major piece of wonky legislation.
Why'd they do that?
The short answer was they felt that it needed to be more developer-friendly. There wasn't enough toys or incentives for developers. At least that was the stated reason. And so the expectation now is that this will return in the coming weeks. And the council plans to essentially start from scratch using a new ad hoc committee. So at an upcoming city council meeting, we expect some members of the city council to be appointed to a special committee that will start this work over. And it's unclear what that ad hoc committee could look like.
Is this going to be another special secret committee, or is this one will be open to public perception or participation?
I think that's the fundamental question that the city council still needs to address.
Okay. All right. Do we have any, has that been discussed yet, or is that still, we're waiting to hear what they were planning to do?
We're waiting to hear.
Okay. I believe, Rob, they called it a specific ad hoc committee, the one that Omar reported on.
Okay. Fantastic. What else is in the news?
Okay. Other stuff, city council also gave the final stamp of approval to a new package of rules and legislations for sidewalk vendors that can operate in the city. The vendors and the spokesman for the vendors associations that we've spoken to don't seem very pleased with the final result.
Is there more restrictions, or what are they upset about?
I think it's the fines and the restrictions, particularly some of the where they're able to be placed during certain hours or certain community events. And then the fines are cost prohibitive from their perspective. It did not get unanimous support. Two council members did vote against it. That was as expected. But at the end of the day, we do now have this new package of rules that the Mobile Vendor Association opposes. A few other interesting notes that happened on Monday. The union that represents the school bus drivers that are contracted to drive some students with special needs at Fresno Unified hosted a kind of a hasty press conference on a Monday morning after a holiday weekend and came together and announced at this news conference that their employer, First Student, had recently fired a supervisor who, according to the employees at the press conference, had sexually harassed at least one employee. And additionally, the employees also alleged wage theft. The company did not want to talk about that at all this week. Fresno Unified issued a statement saying, it's a contract company, these are not Fresno Unified employees, and we expect the employer to do the right thing. All the company would tell us is that they're currently bargaining for a new contract in good faith, but they did not want to answer any questions about wage theft or sexual harassment or any of the employees' claims.
It seems like this is something that should be brought up in a bargaining session with a large school district to ask them about their practices, particularly if you're driving children and some of these activities are going on. It seems like that would be a concern of parents, potentially.
Definitely, and I think that the lack of answers coming from the company and from the district are probably going to continue to move this story forward until there's some kind of understanding about what the company is doing to ensure that the people who are in charge of driving some of our most vulnerable students are good people. There was also a big development on SATA project that we've covered forever and ever, and actually I'll throw it over to Greg for that. He's been our SATA expert.
So the previous summer, I started reporting on this 45,000 home mega development that the city was putting forward that was going to potentially erase any of the climate change progress the city was going to make into the 2040s. The city in 2020, 2021 committed to about 600,000 tons of emissions reductions in the next few decades. And they put forward this housing plan that, according to their environmental review, would have completely negated all that. And so when I asked the city last summer, you're required by law to mitigate this, and you're not mitigating almost any of it right now. How exactly does that square? They told me that they were going to use a greenhouse gas checklist that was a part of their general plan environmental review process. And flash forward a year later to this summer, that greenhouse gas checklist got basically overturned in courts. They said that this was way too weak of a mitigation measure, and developers could choose alternative mitigation measures that would effectively not do anything, and the city had no accountability measures to make sure that developers offset their impacts.
Okay, and why is it in the news this week?
So what happened this week is that the planning department had to go back to the city council and ask for another $150,000 in consultant funds in order to redo the greenhouse gas planning for this mega development.
Wow. I don't know what to say to all that. What is there?
It's a lot to digest.
It's just...
The long and short of it is that...
Yeah, just kind of implicate it for it, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, 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 exactly. So 500,000 tons of CO2 that the city has to potentially mitigate for now in SEDA could be, I estimated in a story this summer, to be maybe $20, $30, $40 million. So this is a lot of money that developers would have to pay to mitigate their impacts on the environment.
Yeah, it feels like there's broad currents right now that are trying to look at obstacles to development. And I know that sometimes environmental impact reports can be cost prohibitive, especially when you got to do a local, a state, and a federal. We also have commitments to deal with the crisis of the environment. And so how we mix those, I think, is the big question. And so what's your sense on local officials and their sense of, is this something that we can push through?
My first story that framed this week's issue at the council, it was published the day of the council meeting, said that there was basically two crises facing the city right now. It's the housing crisis and the climate crisis. And when you look at SEDA, it's arguable that the city, by even potentially approving this, is going to solve neither. Obviously, from what we've previously talked about, it's not going to solve a climate crisis. It's going to probably aggravate it. But on the housing front, the big problem with SEDA is that it's very much focused on single-family homes. And what the city knows, this is in Dyer's One Fresno Housing Plan, is that the city already has a glut, an oversupply of single-family homes by 30,000. So this is not the form of housing that, according to his One Fresno Plan, residents need. They need lower cost housing than single-family homes. And yet this is a sort of development that the city is now trying to bank on with SEDA. And this is a big problem historically for Fresno. What I document in my story is that 90 to 95% of the real estate market for housing in Fresno has been single family homes. So we don't know how to build any other type of housing. And part of the housing crisis that we're going through right now is that we have a glut of single family homes, and yet this is the only thing that developers want to build. And it's running to all sorts of issues, from profitability, because housing construction's declined 4 years in a row now in Fresno, to climate issues.
Is this like the housing policy equivalent of drinking yourself sober?
You know what? Yeah, there's contradictions are really hard to work through in the modern economy. But yeah, I think it's a fair assessment.
All right. We'll be watching to see how the city chooses to thread this needle that makes no one happy. And that's what's been in the news this week.
Greg Weaver is going to be joining us today. He's going to be talking about a recent settlement that may not be all the city has portrayed it. Over the last summer, Fresno trumpeted what city leaders described as a major victory over these kind of giant chemical companies like Dow and Shell. And that big victory came in the form of a multi-million dollar court settlement that's meant to force these big chemical giants to clean up kind of decades-old pesticide contamination in according to Greg's reporting, in what may be as much as 20% of San Joaquin Valley's drinking water. The city's sent out a press release on August 1, calling it historic and celebrating this $233 million that did end the lengthy court battle that had been going on since, I think, 2007. But a Fresnoland review led by reporter Greg Weaver raises new questions about this deal that Dow and Shell have reached, not only with California's fifth largest city, but cities up and down the state. Industry experts that Greg interviewed described this multi-million dollar payout as a drop in the bucket that's likely to evaporate well before the drinking water supply can be cleaned completely. So I'll turn it over to Greg. So take me back to the beginning. What is the issue with Fresno's drinking water, and how did we get here?
Yeah, so especially in southeast Fresno, the drinking water has this chemical called TCP, and it's a short form of a very long chemical name that doesn't need to be mentioned.
It's a hydrocarbon, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it was one of these chemicals that began to be manufactured by Shell in the 1930s. It was created as part of this revolutionary reaction that they innovated actually in the East Bay. And it was part of all these new chemicals that Shell was creating. They were using it to make weather coats and fake leathers and all sorts of things. And one of the chemicals that Shell found was really effective was as a fumigant for soils. And the San Joaquin Valley ended up using this fumigant for many years. And the problem was...
By fumigant, you're meaning a pesticide, correct?
Yes, exactly. Okay. A pesticide. This pesticide's called DD. And just as a... DD is highly toxic. It's banned in 34 countries. The United States still allow farmers to use it. And it was banned in California for about 5 years because of how widespread it was being used in the San Joaquin Valley, that it was literally in the air. Between 1990 and 1995, California found this and were like, oh my God, we got to find a way to stop this. The problem is that DD also had another chemical that Shell and Dow had put into that product, and it was TCP. TCP is highly toxic. It doesn't degrade. It'll be in the water, unless we filter it, for millions of years. And the city is asking Shell and Dow, 07?
07.
Yep.
And 17 years ago, the city filed a suit asking Shell and Dow to pay to help clean up these costs. And what my reporting shows is that this settlement is likely not enough. The State Water Board said that the city settlement and almost every other settlement that has been filed over TCP is likely not a long-term solution to actually cleaning the water of TCP. What the story really raises is, why exactly did we spend 17 years in court and we still don't even know what the true cost of cleanup would be for what may be one of the biggest regional contamination cases in U.S. history?
So I have a number of follow-up questions. I guess the first one is it still in use? Are we still, and have remediation processes start? Did we wait for the ruling before remediation began, or has that been ongoing while this court case has been proceeding?
So after the state pesticide regulators in the 90s discovered that this toxic fumigant, this toxic pesticide, was literally in the air, they also started testing the water, and that's when they found the TCP. And it took about 20 years for them to put forward a public drinking water standard. They put it forward in 2017. And so since 2017, 2018, public utilities have been required to filter TCP from the water. What these settlements try to accomplish is having the chemical companies pay for the cost of filtration, which is extremely expensive. The settlement is not enough because you have to buy extremely expensive filters. They're called granular activated carbon filters that require massive amounts of energy to push that water through the filter. It's a bit like why desalinization is so expensive. It's this massive energy cost of moving water.
Because there's upfront costs and then there's recurring costs per unit.
Exactly. Yeah. The units cost tens, hundreds of millions of dollars, and then it also costs millions of dollars in electricity fees to put that water through a filter. Yeah.
So wait, if they've only been doing this since 2017 or thereabouts, I live in Fresno. Is my water safe to drink?
Oh, it's safe to drink now. It's unclear exactly how much of the water was unsafe to drink before 2017.
And the externalities include cancer, a lot of the things that we associate with what PFAS or other chemicals in water, forever chemicals, things like this, where there's these long-term health effects. And, you know, how does a settlement resolve that? It doesn't. And that legacy of people that have been drinking water in Fresno, when their long-term health outcomes from this, that doesn't address that at all.
Absolutely not. No, I think when it comes to class action lawsuits on existing damages, it would require very expensive epidemiology studies. And those have never been conducted in the San Joaquin Valley over this issue.
And Fresno's not the only community where that's received a settlement like this.
No, I think there's been close to $1 billion in settlements. That may be an underestimate even.
Do we have a sense of how far this problem of contaminated water extends in California?
almost anywhere that had industrial agriculture after 1940 likely used this chemical. The reason why it's such an issue in the San Joaquin Valley is because this is the most intensified agricultural system possibly on Earth, and it has a huge amount of TCP contamination. But it also exists in Santa Clara, it exists in Los Angeles, where famously there was orange groves and stuff before San Fernando Valley got turned into homes.
On reading the coverage about this earlier this fall, this result was celebrated. So what are they missing?
That's a great question, because it looks like Fresno did get more money than some other cities too, like Bakersfield.
Yeah.
The issue that's raised in this piece is that the city hasn't fully characterized the actual contamination underneath the ground. So they don't actually have any idea of how long it's going to take. This is what some public officials within the city told me. And so what the State Water Board said is that, yes, these settlements are big, but they're likely not going, even after all the funds are expended, all the money is spent, the water's not going to be clean afterwards.
I see. So this is going to be a recurring cost for people because maybe I'm misunderstanding. Does it also get into the soil, if you will, and then it's just a permanent kind of fixture in what our water seeps through, if you will? Water and things like that, as we get more and more houses that are pushed out on the periphery of the city, getting well water, is this going to be an issue for them as well?
Absolutely. The Southeast development area that we're talking about, if that is built, they're going to need wells, and they're sitting on contaminated groundwater. So of the contaminated groundwater with TCP in it. So
that means more infrastructure outlays by the city, more costs, pass that on to the taxpayers, not to the Shell and the companies responsible.
Absolutely.
Okay. So Greg, before this settlement, who was paying for the cost to filter the water?
It was the city ratepayers, millions of dollars a year.
So listeners, that is you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
One of the things your reporting also uncovered was the fact that this $233 million settlement won't all be spent on filtering this contaminated water. In fact, most of it won't be spent on that. Is that correct?
Yeah. We got $233 million from Shell and Dow, and roughly $50 million of that went to the attorneys who spent 17 years in negotiations to get that settlement. And then another $100-something million went to actually buying the filters themselves to install on these groundwater pumping stations. So after you account for that, the city has roughly $42 million left to actually begin filtering the water. So that $42 million will go towards basically the electricity costs and upkeep, which is only going to last 7 to 10 years, which is only going to last about 7 years from the annual cost estimations that the city gave me.
After the money runs out, what happens?
We're going to have to pay to filter this water again indefinitely.
Ratepayers.
Exactly.
Where is this story going from here, Greg?
The big picture that a San Joaquin Valley resident really needs to understand from this isn't about the negotiations. It's not about the legal settlement. It's a story about how around the 1940s, three California areas underwent economic revolutions. The LA built war planes. Silicon Valley built computers, and the San Joaquin Valley really had a revolution in industrial agriculture. And this fumigant was the key part of this. It allowed for new operations to have incredible yields year after year that weren't possible before. And the end part of the story talks about how the most powerful environmental laws in the country have saved LA, and they have saved Silicon Valley from the aftershocks of these revolutions. The airplane hangars contaminated LA's water with TCP, but the EPA forced Lockheed Martin to filter the water until it was clean to drink, and it got all the TCP out of the ground. That water's clean to drink. In Santa Clara County, all these computer chip manufacturers had to be made to pay to clean up for their chemical contamination. What this story shows is that for the rural San Joaquin Valley, there is no federal legislation that will result in a permanent cleanup unless the EPA takes drastic action, which is an extremely unlikely possibility now, considering the Trump administration is going to be coming in. And so really speaks to how you can have these very profitable economic systems using chemicals that generate externalities on residents. And for two of these economic landscapes, it was effective. But for the San Joaquin Valley, we're just left out in the cold.
So it's a story about clout. It's a story about, to quote the great writer Jared Haslam, Central Valley is the other California. All right, we're going to close today with our favorite segment, which is what we're loving this week. We'll start with Rob. Rob, what are you loving this week?
I'm loving this week my favorite sandwich in Fresno. It's called the Chop Smoke. You can get it at My Guy Market. I agreed with a poll last year that says it's the most underrated restaurant in Fresno. The Chop Smoke says it's an 8-inch hero roll filled with ground beef, onions, and, quote, hella American cheese. My Guy sauce, applewood smoked bacon, and the part that makes it for me, spicy chopped cherry peppers. If you have not had this sandwich, you're not as happy in your life as you could be.
Yeah, what's his name again? What's his name again?
The chef's name is Wu Tangzi, and My Guy Market is a ghost kitchen, a virtual bodega, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
It's available online. Highly recommend if you're a DoorDash person, at least check out the online menu there.
He legit, he went to New York,
yeah,
and learned how to do it and brought it back to Fresno and is doing it with what I think is like almost complete fidelity.
Because
a chopped cheese is a staple on the other coast. 100%. On the other coast, not the right coast, but the other coast.
The wrong.
Yeah, so you get the one where you extract the bone from the rib. There is something somewhat graphic but beautiful about pulling that bone out of that dinosaur rib. Ooh, yeah, that's incredible. What else has he got on the menu? He's got a bunch of stuff on there?
Yeah, the Chop Smoke, there's the Chop Cheese, like we were just talking about, and he's got a few other, I think, original sandwiches, but he's also got like a great breakfast sandwich if you're into like the bacon, egg, and cheese on a roll. They're just great sandwiches.
And he's got a lot of riz on social media.
Yeah,
he's worth watching in general.
If you're hearing this for the first time, the Fresno Bee had a really great profile on Wu Tangzi when he first opened My Guy, I want to say a year and a half ago. But if you haven't checked out the Chop Smoke sandwich, go be happy this weekend and get one.
Greg, what are you loving this week?
This one's a more public health oriented recommendation. I hate to rain on the parade of the Chop Cheese.
You're going to go from Chop Cheese to public health.
This may be helpful for the holiday seasons. It's helpful for me all year, but I don't want to get people that I know sick with COVID. And obviously masking is one thing, but when you're like having a personal setting, it's hard to mask up. The big problem in my life has been that these antigen tests, the common ones you find over the counter, they're just not sensitive enough to capture the sort of asymptomatic spread of COVID, or somebody has just a little sore throat and they'll give it to you. That's actually when it's most communicable. And this is a big reason why it's had real staying power in our society. And the gold standard on this are these PCR tests, the ones that you go to CVS and you do the swab and it takes 2 weeks or something, a few days at the very least, to get a result. But over the last year, this German company just put out, that has been verified in like the world's top scientific journal, Nature, a at-home PCR machine that has a per test cost that is actually lower than the antigen tests you can get at Rite Aid. It's actually, I checked today, my PCR test costs $8 per test, and the ones at Rite Aid that are almost useless for preventing COVID spread cost $15 a
pop. So is it like a little box or something you stick on your calendar? How much is the upfront cost for the little box?
So that's the catch, is it's $300. I just read that this guy who was one of the key innovators of the AI revolution we have right now, Ian Goodfellow, he works at Apple right now, got COVID and he's having after effects that really make it difficult to do his job. And $200-$300, you're able to keep everybody you love safe if anybody's concerned about it. And it's actually lower per unit than an antigen test. It's just been incredibly useful for me because it effectively is what the tests show is that this PCR machine is literally a million times more sensitive to detecting COVID than what you get over the counter. I guess what's most infuriating to me is that this isn't something that's subsidized by the government at this point. But yeah, if you don't want to get COVID and you got $300, it's by Altruin. That's what I'm loving is this thing.
If you got $315, you can get one of these machines and a chop smoke.
That, two for one. I think they should roll it in as a combo. I'm going to be at, we're recording this on December 6th. And so I'm going to be at the Fresno Philharmonic's annual holiday concert in a room, tightly compacted, with people with weakened immune systems. I'm not making any generalizations about the age of the other concert goers, but they tend to be older. And so having that comfort and knowledge seems like it's worth the cost of a couple $100. So what I'm loving this week is two things. First, I'll start with the more serious thing. Across the world, we're seeing the growth of illiberalism. Democracy's in decline, if you will. We can see this in a lot of different places. And we had an incident this past week where the president of South Korea tried, and I'm going to emphasize the word tried, to institute martial law, citing that there were foreign elements from North Korea infecting the parliament or legislature. And the legislature stood up to him, and he backed down. This could have turned into another nightmare scenario where you have an out-of-control, autocratic-style president overreaching, overstepping their bounds. And we saw democracy stand up and withstand the powers of coercion by an executive. And that's a great thing for the world. We're not seeing a lot of that right now, and so I just wanted to comment. That's making me happy.
Power to the people.
That's right. And the other thing that's making me happy is Christmas cookies. I love Christmas cookies. And I would argue that the best cookie to make during this holiday season is shortbread cookies. And here's why. You can put a lot of different substances on top. You can put a lemon drizzle. You can put a peppermint cream. You can put really anything. And the great thing about shortbread cookies, they don't get stale. At least not quickly. And so you could make a batch right now, put them in a little box, save them for the holidays, and they'll be just as fresh 2 weeks from now.
I think what this is actually an advertisement for is the power of butter.
Yes, butter is powerful. The other thing that I do, and I don't know if you guys are into this, I also make my own eggnog in December. Do you guys?
I love eggnog.
Yes, oh eggnog God. Is so, to say it's underrated is probably absurd because lots of people love eggnog. But I would say making your own is underrated. That store-bought schlock that you get from Save Mart is just not the same as whipping your own cream, not whipping your own cream, but making your own batch at home. And so what I do every beginning of every December is I get the sugar, I get the cream, I get the milk, I get whiskey and rum because I do a combo, and I make it without cooking it, which requires aging it. And so I age it for 3 weeks, and I always do it December 1st. So December 21st is when I can, speaking of public health, start to have my health decline for the maybe 5 to 6 days that follow the day that I crack open the first bottle of eggnog. Good. And it's incredible. And I look forward to it every year.
I don't know if I've ever heard anyone talk about making their own eggnog. That sounds like a black belt cooking move.
Oh, and it's relatively easy. And I've spent a lot of time perfecting my recipe. And this year, the one thing I'm adding is I'm adding cinnamon sticks to the eggnog and letting them sit in the eggnog. Yeah. This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Rob Parsons.
And I'm Gregory Weaver.
And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.